Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today we're going to talk about the recent history of globalization. Many of you listeners may know that I had a book out called Out of Sight in 2015 that was looking at the larger history of globalization and the kind of disasters that it spawns around the world. And this is something that means a whole lot to me. And you know, it's long been my contention that progressives don't really take these issues seriously enough in our politics. And I still certainly very much feel that way. And today we are here to talk to Paul Adler, who is an assistant professor of history at Colorado College. And he has an incredibly important and brand new book out about this very issue, No Globalization Without Representation, U.S. Activists and World Inequality. It's just out from the University of Pennsylvania Press. And so we're going to spend some time talking to Paul today about these issues. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Wonderful to be here.
Would you start by describing your book a little bit?
Yeah, so No Globalization Without Representation is the story of the emergence of a coalition of generally liberal left groups in the United States concerned with the inequalities spawned by particularly neoliberal forms of globalization that arose in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And the book examines a variety of campaigns that different, mainly nonprofit advocacy groups waged starting in the late 1970s, with the main part of the book going through the battle in Seattle in 1999 to try to create what they viewed as a more democratic and fairer form of global economic integration.
So if we go back to the 1970s, let's say, right, is the, we'll get into a minute, in a minute, the sort of the structures of some of these groups and who these people are, but what is the, you know, but by the 1970s, the modern system of globalization has, you know, been growing apace since at the very least the end of World War II. And, you know, if you can summarize what is no doubt a really complicated question, what is the overall state of the globalization project by, say, the early 70s that these people are going to start responding to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, as you say, there's sort of this post-1945, post-World War II capitalist global integration project that is mainly about kind of fusing Western Europe and to the United States, to sort of the other global North capitalist countries, Australia, Canada, so forth. You know, it's run by kind of very mild social democrats. It's as a governance project, much more about kind of Cold War security than like promoting kind of a maximalist capitalist vision, right? It's a project that looks to have room for example, European social democracy. So that's for the rich countries. For the, you know, newly decolonized, in at least a certain political sense, countries of sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, along with many Latin American countries, there are these questions about what does integration look like in a world of all these nation states and not the big colonial empires, and a lot of attention to inequalities created that are sort of the continuing effects of the structures that centuries of formal colonialism built. So that's kind of, it's a very dramatic in some ways, but also kind of oddly quiet setting to come into, where there's not one dominant paradigm kind of ruling global economic integration, but several, those two, and then obviously the sort of communist world.
So, you know, I think that if we, this will make become more salient to listeners when we explore this in some more detail. So maybe that makes sense to kind of do that, right? So your book starts, the big campaign is the Nestle campaign, right? And so as a way of starting to sort of make this more concrete, talk about what Nestle's doing on a global scale and why this becomes outrageous to so many people.
Yeah, so it's sort of building on the last answer moving forward. You know, there's a long history of multinational corporations. In the 1970s, there's kind of a further growth of multinationals as sort of new markets are opening up, as sort of the developmentalism in countries like Brazil or East Asian countries is growing. And so multinationals see markets outside of like Western Europe and the sort of North American and capitalist world. For Nestle and a number of other companies, among many consumer products that they are increasingly pushing are a variety of breast milk substitutes. Now, the issue here was not the existence of breast milk substitutes, right? There's a quite rich and intense and important set of debates about breastfeeding, breast milk substitutes. The issue here was the marketing techniques used by multinationals like Nestle in especially sort of more rural areas in more impoverished parts of the global South, which is not, hey, like maybe you have trouble breastfeeding and there's an alternative, but like breastfeeding is a sign of sort of backwardsness, right? And underdevelopment. Substitutes are modernity and technology and capitalism. And it's not just that you're putting that on a billboard. You know, one of the worst things Nestle was doing was they would hire people to essentially pretend to be professional health workers to go to like newborn clinics and just like promote substitutes to people who had just given birth. And so the further issue with the marketing, because, you know, marketing, it's a problem, can be a problem, but the real material thing was if people started using the substitutes in conditions where they didn't have access to clean water, they didn't have access to refrigeration. Also, they just, you know, didn't have a lot of money, so they were potentially watering down the substitutes. That could lead to much increased risks of infant illness and death. So that was the big issue that a group of different public health experts had been trying to raise since the 1930s, but that public interest groups that I focus on turn into a politicized organizing campaign in the mid and late 1970s.
Okay, so before we get into the people who make this a campaign, how does this Nestle campaign reflect the larger system of globalization that is developing in the immediate post-colonial period?
Yeah, so one of the big signs of it is that it is a sign of multinational corporations that are based in Western Europe and other rich capitalist countries seeing third world peoples as consumers of day-to-day consumer products. Most of the foreign direct investment by multinationals in the, you know, the global South, the third world, prior to sort of the 1970s was in, you know, a few key extractive sectors, right? It was like, hey, your country has a bunch of fertile agricultural land. We're going to grow like this one breed of a cash crop, or hey, nice rocks you have in that mountain. Like they do nicely for us to burn and, you know, or like use in some sort of industrial product. But now with a company like Nestle, it's like, oh, but people can also just buy our stuff, like our consumer products. So that was sort of one of the big signs of this kind of evolution of, you know, what the activists I write about came by the 1990s to call corporate globalization. So a specific kind of international economic integration that is very favorable and often driven by multinationals.
So I want to come back to that a little bit later, but I think we've laid that out plenty well for now. So why don't you start talking about some of the people that become engaged in this issue? You use this term called public interest progressives. Can you talk a little bit about that and give some examples of who these people are?
Yeah, so this is, I think, a very important point for the book in sort of identifying my actors, because they're actors who haven't necessarily been written about so much, at least by historians. So what I call public interest progressives are a specific group arising in the 1960s with Ralph Nader as kind of the peak public interest progressive. They have intellectual, political kind of forebears, so to speak, and especially like New Deal technocrats of the 1930s. But the public interest progressives are folks who are liberals in this like 1960s sense, often maybe a little more left than, say, a Lyndon Johnson or John Kennedy, but who believe in, you know, work it, you know, as I say, the good parts of the system to beat the bad parts of the system. I quote David Browder, former Sierra Club head and founder of Friends of the Earth. So they're coming of age politically in kind of the early mid 1960s. They're interested in consumer safety, right? Nader with car safety. They're interested in environmentalism, workplace safety. They look around. The battles for them to fight are not to create a Securities and Exchange Commission or some other kind, you know, some of these basic regulatory agencies, although they do help create like the EPA, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and OSHA. But what they see is sort of a federal regulatory apparatus that has roughly existed for, you know, 30 years, some agencies even longer, that needs reviving, right? It's agencies that, you know, sometimes it's underfunding and it's poor management. Often there's also a certain amount of corporate capture, right? Where the regulators and the companies they regulate, like, have kind of gotten too close to each other. And they also see new issues, especially some environmental protections where there's a need for an expanded federal role. And so what they see themselves as is citizen advocates working to make the regulatory state the best possible regulatory state that it could be. So they're going to become professionalized experts. They're going to become advocates. They're going to learn the intricacies of how corporations work, of how federal regulatory agencies work, of how Congress works. And, you know, from their mindset, they're going to push and prod and ally with whomever is sort of more their opponents or more their friends within these bodies, and be a kind of permanent watchdog on those agencies. And then the other key thing is they see themselves as interlocutors between the citizenry and these big institutions, in the sense of it is really, there's a lot of complexity in, right, how Congress works, how a company works, how a regulatory agency works. So what they see themselves as is people's experts, right? They will be the experts on how these things work, but in the, their actions will serve kind of the public interest, quote unquote. So that's who the public interest progressives were. And again, Nader is kind of the prime example of this. And where I pick up the story and really focus on them is in this late 1970s period, where there's this slice of public interest progressives who are taking an interest in not just corporate malfeasance within a U.S. domestic context, but also overseas.
So could you give us an example of one of these people and the ways in which he or she becomes a public interest progressive?
Yeah, so I think the Nestle boycott is actually a really interesting version of this, because it is partly the story of how some kind of white 60s, more like leftists become public interest progressives, but also change in some ways the direction of the public interest progressive. It's not really a movement, but the political formation. So a great example is Leah Margulies. Maybe a pink diaper baby. I don't know when your like family are socialists, but not communists. You know, they're in the sellout ILGWU, not the, you know, the pure UE. But she, you know, grows up in this New York milieu. She's very involved, you know, gets involved with like civil rights protests. She gets involved with kind of second wave feminism. She's in the New Haven Women's Liberation Rock Band. And then she gets a job as a research assistant for a Yale professor studying multinational corporations and just becomes, you know, obsessed with learning all the like technical details of how these companies operate and everything. And, you know, she's looking for a job in sort of the mid 1970s and wants to do something activist, right? But this is, you know, SDS doesn't exist anymore. Like SNCC doesn't exist anymore. So she gets a job at the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which is a public interest group started by a group of mainline Protestant churches, some Catholic orders, I believe some synagogues, to do sort of faith-based corporate accountability work. And she is really interested in doing a campaign that's global and focused, and through her research, you know, comes across the writings about infant formula and basically road tests it with churches and finds that, oh, people are really, can be really quickly mobilized around that. And so she, you know, starts organizing a campaign, but it's, again, it's a very public interest campaign through a very public interest group, right? So it's not like, oh, shut down the headquarters or do a mass protest, whatever. It's like, okay, we got lawsuits, we got shareholder resolutions, we got maybe congressional hearings, right? These kind of more institutional tools to try to make change.
Well, and then I think this leads to a bigger question, right? Which is that there's a kind of, and I think we all on the left sort of feel this way on a certain level, that the kind of mass action in the streets, the protests, shutting things down is a kind of the be all and end all of activism. And I may be overstating that, but you know, it's not by that much. And yet the public interest progressives, as you're describing, take a very different tact, right? I mean, you know, things like lawsuits and corporate campaigns and this sort of more sophisticated kind of organizing. And I guess that the, not downside, but that some people might say is a downside, is that it's not mobilizing the people for direct action in the same way as like Birmingham marches or something like that. Is this sort of tension part of the conversation at all as this is developing?
Yeah, so 2 points on that. First, I think it's critical that when public interest progressivism, it's sort of golden era, I'd say is like 65 to sometime in the mid 70s. And the mass movements of the 60s actually are helpful in some ways because the public interest progressives can make pretty, like, I think especially in our current context, real demands, right? We need new federal regulatory agencies like OSHA or the Environmental Protection Agency. We need like really strong laws, but they don't have to mobilize the mass base because there's already a mass base demanding, right? You know, socialism, the overthrow of the government, right? And so they seem so moderate by comparison, but by comparison to like transformative revolutionary demands, so that like, you know, quite liberal social democratic demands look very boring. The other thing is with the Nestle boycott, and this is a tension I talk about throughout the whole book, is that the groups I talk about and especially focus on that got involved in globalization were not completely anti-mass mobilization. They just didn't see it as necessary because, especially in the 60s, they won all these victories without having to do sort of disruptive mass long-term social movement organizing. But with the Nestle boycott, I think one of the interesting stories with it is that it's about the fusion of public interest and kind of more grassroots organizing, because Margulies, the lawsuits, the hearings, the shareholder resolutions don't really go anywhere. And so after a long series of deliberations with an activist core, but also with all these churches, and again, that's sort of an institutional grassroots, they conclude that a consumer boycott is the best solution. And I mean, people can critique boycotts from the left, but that is definitely a tactic that is about mobilizing large amounts of people, you know, not necessarily like with a boycott, not to take risks to their personal safety and the way shutting down a street or a meeting is, but still it's to get out there and it's to organize, right? It's to get people who are not politicized involved. And that is what happens with the Nestle boycott that then also interestingly leads it to become a public interest campaign in a different way when they go more global with their advocacy work and trying to get a code of conduct through the United Nations to regulate in some way the marketing and promotion of breast milk substitutes.
So why don't you sort of take us through the history of the Nestle boycott relatively quickly? In fact, some longtime LGM readers may remember that many, many years ago, you actually wrote a post for the Labor History series on the Nestle boycott, which remains on the site today. But could you give just like the 2-minute overview of the Nestle boycott and what happens?
Sure. So I kind of led up to the point where they decide to launch the boycott. Boycott grows quite quickly nationally. It helps lead to a Senate hearing where the Nestle representative embarrasses himself before Ted Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy makes fun of him. Ted Kennedy then helps facilitate a dialogue between United Nations, INFACT, which is the boycott organizing group, and Nestle to have a conference about breast milk substitutes held in Geneva. That happens, and World Health Organization, UNICEF, say, we're going to like have a code of conduct. Like, we will manage a legally non-binding code of conduct. The activists support that. It is passed in 1981. The United States government, which has just switched to Reagan, is the only government in the world to vote against this code of conduct. The boycott carries forward for a few years with some real ups and downs. And then in 84, an agreement is reached where Nestle will abide by the code. Nestle has broken that promise in various ways over the years, and other companies have actually been worse about it. But also, I would say that the code and the continuing advocacy by it has certainly not solved this problem, but has had material benefits and at least lessening it as a problem, right? And when you, that sounds boring, reformist, and whatever. But like when you translate that down to real life, that means like there are people who are alive who might not have been because of the campaign.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, this kind of idea that, you know, boring is bad or whatever is, I think, damaging. But one thing I think that was really interesting about your book is that you're also exploring that there are real tensions between these first world or global north public interest progressives and these global south activists. And can you talk about that relationship and the tensions in, you know, that maybe are perhaps inherent in a truly globalized movement?
Yeah, those are definitely present. Although what I also try to get across from my research in the book is that I also think there are some examples of relatively healthy relationships between north-south groups in these stories. So there is a great book to be written about Penang in Western Malaysia, a hub for global south to south activism. And in the case of the story I'm telling, it goes with a consumer advocacy group called the Consumers Association of Penang, which was to cover, consumer issues can seem really non-threatening. And so this group organized around consumer issues as a way of not being repressed by the government while they did all kinds of more politicized activism. And out of that rose a person named Anwar Fazal, who's a very impressive individual, who within a few years goes from being a sort of local Malaysian consumer activist to being elected president of the International Organization of Consumers Unions, which is like the main body of consumer advocacy groups in the world and is overwhelmingly a very like moderate European and US-based group. But Fazal just, you know, he worked it. He did a, you know, he did very effective work. He gets elected president and tries to turn IOCU into a truly global organization. He ties in with the boycott. There's a start of an organization that's more based in the global South, a network of different like nonprofits, feminist organizations, consumer groups that is participating in the campaign, not by boycotting, but by monitoring and reporting on abuses of the code of conduct and also pushing national governments in the third world to pass legally binding laws. And I think for a while that relationship actually worked pretty well because it played to the strengths of the different groups, right? Like the US groups weren't like, oh, we'll send a bunch of white people to rural Kenya to like find out and save you, right? It's like, no, we're gonna boycott because we're where the consumer base is. And like you all observe, and then conversely, right, the Global South groups are like, we're not the main consumers of like Nestle products, but like when you boycott, that gives us power. So that works with tensions, but pretty well for a while. The real explosion point with the Nestle boycott is that the US boycott by sort of 1984 is just kind of collapsing from exhaustion. Churches are leaving, people are leaving. They've having trouble having sustained financing. An opportunity arises to end the boycott, and the US group essentially takes it without consultation, both with their Global South partners, but also with their Western European partners. And that leads to this huge kerfuffle in early 1984 at a global conference about the campaign, about just the US. I mean, this is the more sort of typical story that I think a lot of the listeners will know, of just like arrogant, predominantly white people thinking they know best and like doing things without consultation. So that was a major piece of the story. I do think part of the relative ease with which that transnational linkages work is that there are certainly these national differences, but the people involved had similar socioeconomic kind of backgrounds, right? Like Anwar Fazal and some of the other advocates, like, who were leaders in the Global South networks, were still people with like kind of formalized university educations. Malaysia, right, had been a British colony, so you had people who spoke English. And so I think that helps explain some of the relative smoothnesses, that the differences weren't as vast as like, you know, a highly formally educated US activist trying to work with like, you know, rural farmers in somewhere in the Global South where there's just so many differences in experience, context, even material interest.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess, you know, she mentioned the boycott kind of is falling apart by the mid 80s. I mean, I feel like so much of our narratives, the 80s are this turning point away from collective action toward neoliberalism, the global turn of the right, the rise of Reagan and Thatcher, and other lovely people like that. So how, you know, and then your book sort of, you know, spans this period of the 80s. And then, you know, you see this globalized movement, or this movement for, you know, fair globalization sort of reach a peak in the 90s in opposition to NAFTA, and then leading to the World Trade Organization protest and the Battle of Seattle. So, you know, can we move forward a little bit? Like, how do the How do these groups respond to the new political realities of the 80s, the rise of neoliberalism, and then into the early 90s?
Yeah, so, you know, I do tell the story that I think is pretty familiar of the rise of, like, global neoliberalism in the 80s. The actors I look at during that period, especially the mid and late 80s, are less political players who are having some effect on policy and are more grappling with what's happening, right? Like, there's a lot of changes going on in the 1980s. Like, the Cold War is ending. People, you know, in that context are like, what is going on? What does this even mean? So then where I jump to is the early 90s, where there are a series of initiatives to kind of entrench neoliberal policy in governance through free trade agreements, through institutions like the World Trade Organization, so on and so forth. And for the story I'm telling, NAFTA is a huge piece of that. And the importance of NAFTA is not that it was like an early neoliberal initiative. NAFTA is a culmination of like one phase of neoliberalism. NAFTA was about, you know, solidifying this through reform through agreement. And, you know, I think it's very interesting that the impetus for it more comes from, you know, one of the great leaders of the late 20th century, Carlos Salinas of Mexico, never saw an election he didn't want to steal. And, you know, that's sort of this Mexican political elite that's been pushing neoliberal reform, especially since the 82 debt crisis, and wants to formalize it. So NAFTA is taking ideas from all, you know, like different trade agreements that were just about literal free trade in products, taking ideas from what were called bilateral investment treaties, which are about sort of protecting corporate interests, and just like shoves it all together into this big thing. And why that then becomes important for sort of progressives in the US is that NAFTA has direct impacts, not just over there, quote unquote, in the global South, but in the United States, right? The Nestle issue, there was some question about infant formula marketing in the US, but it was much more like a challenge for especially impoverished peoples in parts of the global South. But with NAFTA, it's like, well, this is going to accelerate deindustrialization. This is going to accelerate like challenges for family farmers. This is going to accelerate attacks on environmental laws and potentially consumer laws. So you create the conditions for building a much bigger coalition than sort of predominantly white, middle class, nonprofit advocates. And so the story that I tell us of how these public interest groups made stronger linkages with especially organized labor, also family farm groups, and a number of other actors materially implicated in the agreement and put on a hell of a fight, right? The NAFTA fight still is one of the really big knockdown, drag-out legislative fights of the past few decades. And I think critically, for understanding its importance, that it wasn't really till the last few weeks, right before the vote, that there seemed to be clarity it would pass. For most of the time, NAFTA was in the public eye and being debated before its passage. The general consensus was like, it's was up in the air of whether it would pass. And there were certain points where it just seemed like it probably would not pass.
Yeah, and you know, I think that in your book, I think makes this clear is that the you know, progressives may have lost the NAFTA fight, but for the rest of the decade, these issues of trade, you know, on a global scale, were part of the global consciousness and political consciousness in the U.S. in a way that they have not been before or since. And, you know, and you see other, you know, the end of the Cold War is obviously a piece of this. The rise of the Zapatistas, you know, in Mexico becomes a kind of piece of that world. And there's all in the, then eventually the rise of United Students Against Sweatshops, all of this leading to the WTO protests in Seattle. So, you know, in the period after the passage of NAFTA, how do public interest progressives build on this to reach a kind of peak of this movement of power?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I have this sort of reflection that January 1st, 1995 was kind of like the nadir of this fair globalization coalition, which is it's the day that essentially the World Trade Organization went online. It was the 1 year anniversary of NAFTA implementation. And so there's a lot of conversation, a lot of trying to build that, you know, goes a fair amount towards making the coalition stronger, right? Like hire people to be grassroots organizers. But the big thing is that like NAFTA kind of does the things that a lot of them had warned about, right? Like, you know, there are factories moving to Mexico. There are, you know, investment provisions in NAFTA being used to challenge environmental laws. Really, you know, in the US and in Mexico, certainly. So those are two things. Another feature that I sort of weave in a little bit is actually just information technology change, that the ability of communication, especially globally, to be much faster is really helpful. It's sort of this nice little era where it's like, oh, the internet was doing a bunch of good things for progressivism before, you know, the Twitter. And then another thing with some of the story I am telling is that actually political polarization works in the favor of progressives on this specific issue. So I can, let me say that more precisely. A big fight is around fast track. Fast track is like such a boring procedural thing. It's like, it's a law that sets the conditions for how trade agreements are passed, and it limits the ability of Congress to amend bills before they're passed. But it's really crucial to the whole US-inspired end of the neoliberal governance agenda, right? It's like allows for agreements to be passed more easily. But it also is renewed every 5 years. So a renewal fight comes up. And the public interest progressives just with their, you know, and the unions just do a pretty masterful job of like channeling anger over NAFTA towards fast track so that they're not spending time explaining all the boring procedural stuff. It's just like fast track will bring more NAFTAs, like end of story. But then also polarization helps them out, but not in a way where they're passive actors, right? They like know this is happening and are weaving and using it, right? So the 94 election knocks off a bunch of Democrats. The Republicans have a majority, but more of the Democrats who left are actually kind of more labor Democrats, not necessarily like progressives, but like, you know, their labor is one of their main constituencies. So the public interest progressives help kind of lock in the Democrats. And then it's kind of a challenge to the Republicans. What do you care more about? Your professed ideology of like free trade and more capitalism, or like constant middle fingering destruction of anything Bill Clinton wants to do, right? And so that's a situation where like it helps and they help defeat fast track. A second victory of this time, which goes to the communication and movement building angle, is there's an attempt through the of rich countries to create what was called a multilateral agreement on investment, which would basically be a sort of mega, like a multinational corporate bill of rights, just like enforce, like providing a global structure for increased corporate power. But because it's being negotiated among all these countries, and because the fair globalizers I talked about in the US have been working to create global networks, and because communication technology allows them to just talk to each other so much faster, they organize a very, I think, just like brilliant, in not even an ideological sense, just in a like, how do you get done the thing you want to get done campaign, sinking the MAI by a tactic they called monkey wrenching, which was basically you accentuate the differences between the different countries' negotiators to the point where the whole thing collapses, right? So you get the French to just be like, you know, we'll never be able to produce any of our great directors ever again, right? If this agreement passes, because all these, like, you know, because our laws about like cultural content protection and like not allowing X amount of foreign content in, you know, and then with like U.S. state legislators, you know, it's like, oh, this is gonna undermine the ability for sort of local regulations and local promotion. And, you know, with the Finns, it's about environmental regulation. And so the whole thing collapses, and that's the MAI, I mean, and the campaign is really successful. And this is actually some of the backstory to Seattle, in that Clinton really wanted a win on his globalization agenda after these defeats. And so the WTO ministerial, and ministerials are these regular WTO meetings that are sort of the grand negotiations to expand the scope of the WTO, this kind of policy purview. He really wants that. And so he's bringing it to the US, and that's why the meeting is there.
So, What you know, in Seattle, you know, it's a famous event. We know there's the giant protest, the police repression, yeah, the anarchists, and all this. What should we know about? What should we know about Seattle that is, you know, that more complicates this basic narrative that we have of it?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. One is the core lesson, I think, of Seattle, that's both very historically contextual to its moment, but has broad wisdom, I think, for progressive left, is the protests work because groups with very disparate political views, both about sort of policy, but also tactics, for the most part, with the exclusion of the Black Bloc, who didn't talk to anyone and just did their thing, everyone's sort of enough in contact with each other, especially through certain interlocutors, like Mike Dolan, who's the organizer for the Citizens Trade Campaign, that they just avoid like actively stomping on each other, right? It's not that they create a unified message or they have a single program or a single set of tactics, but it's just that they don't get in each other's ways too much. So Seattle works because you have a bunch of the classic phrase of diversity of tactics actually working. And I think in an even broader way than is often remembered, because what's not often talked about as much that I discuss is you've also had some public interest progressives, both US ones, also European ones, also people from the global South, in the meeting, working with the negotiators, especially from like very sort of impoverished, marginalized, like Caribbean and sub-Saharan African countries, kind of partly just offering them technical advice. And that's definitely not a like, oh, because they weren't like smart enough or something. But when you think about these meetings, right, the US will have like hundreds of policy people at the meeting going through all the paperwork and like able to, you know, throw proposal after proposal. You know, a country like Jamaica is sending, what, two people? So it's a capacity question that the NGOs are helping to, in a tiny way, address. You know, so that's a big help to it. And it's also that while there's some, I think, kind of questionable ways that some of the more liberal big groups dealt with some of the more, like, the radical groups, even the Black Bloc, there's a pretty good synergy between the anarchists who are not the Black Bloc smash windows, but are the Direct Action Network, Ruckus Society people. And these are people who are anarchists, but they're like also into tactical specificity, right? They're the ones who actually shut the meeting down by like, you know, having the concrete, you know, arm holders and linkage chaining themselves together. And that really works to slow the meeting down, right? That every hour lost of WTO meeting is an hour of lack of pressure of rich governments trying to pressure negotiators from like global South, especially more impoverished global South countries. It's a moment when the US and EU negotiators aren't hashing out their issues. So that works really well as a symbol of itself of like, oh, we shut down the meeting, but also in very practical effects. Well, the more reformist public interest groups are also kind of working to add pressure on rich country negotiators, you know, through the mass protests and showing that there's just constituencies that don't like neoliberal globalization, and then aiding some of the third world governments not to take like radical political stands, but just to be like, your interests are not being served by these negotiations. It's okay to walk away. And that's what leads to the collapse of the WTO meeting after those 5 days.
So, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, at the end of those meetings, and I wasn't there, but I knew people who were, and, you know, this kind of feeling of like an unexpected optimism and, you know, what's next, and really feeling like this was a movement going forward. And then 9/11 happens. And, you know, it's these movements sort of go poof. I mean, there's are obviously committed people working on them, but in the public sphere and in American left politics, opposing the war in Iraq, in the Bush administration, and the Patriot Act, and all this, you know, becomes a bigger part of the world, and these other issues get sort of left behind. And you know, for a long, long time, I guess ever since 2003 or so, maybe, you know, I've kind of been pondering this and wondering what could have been. And so I guess and why is it that, and what are the lessons as well of it just sort of disappearing like that. And so I don't expect you to answer all those questions, but I'm wondering, you know, about the counterfactual here. You know, do you think, as, you know, somebody who's looked at these movements from a historical perspective, probably more than anybody else in the world, what do you think 9/11 did here? And do you see that things could have been different without 9/11 and the Iraq War?
Yeah, and fortunately, I'm someone who's not of the historical mindset of just like, you know, counterfactuals, like banish thee. So I think, first of all, it's important just to remember, so, you know, Seattle happens, and then it's just what I, you know, building on a lot of social movement sort of theorists, sociologists have talked about, I distinguish that before Seattle, there was a coalition, right? A coalition is where there's linkages, you work on common campaigns, but there's not really a shared identity as a movement. There's not sort of mass sustained street action, that kind of thing. So my argument is that Seattle makes it so that this Fair Globalization Coalition and then these other sort of more radical movements I don't talk about as much, other people have talked about and I'm sure will continue to, kind of fuse together and become a recognizable social movement. And, you know, they're getting tens of thousands of people out to protest after protest, right? You know, I, as a freshman in college, I went up to Quebec City to protest the free trade area of the Americas talks. And part of it being a social movement is it just has a lot of different branches. So I identify kind of four big ones in this period from basically like December 1999 to September 11, 2001. So there's the mass street protests. There's just like going and protesting. There's a variety of kind of consumption work of like, which, you know, under the label of fair trade, right? There's this big expansion and just like, oh, we're kind of creating alternative economies by like buying fair trade fruit and coffee. There is, particularly on campuses, just student activism, as you mentioned, United Students Against Sweatshops, but they're winning concrete material victories for like factory workers all around the world. And then there's sort of the continuation of some of the public interest and fair globalization, you know, legislative campaigns, especially around China's entry to the World Trade Organization. So that's like a pretty healthy, to use a kind of in vogue term, ecosystem for a social movement. And one of the things that I really wanted to emphasize, and maybe this is partly just because I'm still like angry about this on a personal level, is that, you know, I was a sophomore in college and starting to do some organizing to take people to DC, because in the end of September 2001, the IMF and the World Bank were going to be meeting in Washington, DC. And the goal was that the US was going to see its first 100,000 plus person march on these issues. And it was looking like that was plausible. The AFL-CIO had been involved with Seattle, but stepped back from some of the other protests, but was now back on board and actually with like pretty great internationalist rhetoric coming out of the AFL on this at this moment. There were the street radicals, the public interest groups, which had also sort of taken a step back from street protests, were going to get involved. There's going to be a press conference on the morning of September 11th of like some of the big environmental and labor groups announcing their intentions, right? And then, you know, these assholes from Al-Qaeda, like, you know, struck the United States. I am certainly not going to be here and say if not for 9/11, like this movement would have led to like global social democracy, much less democratic socialism or anything. But I find that there's sort of this cynicism about it that I think is overly inflated, that just it was inevitable to quickly decline, especially because you can't keep people involved on international issues. And I think a realistic counterfactual is that the movement would have sort of worked to more and more bring in domestic global connections in more healthy internationalist ways. And you saw this some with United Students Against Sweatshops, right, which didn't disappear after 9/11, but became a mix of doing international solidarity work and then helping campus workers organize unions with quite a lot of success. You know, and you saw this with sort of fair trade products, right, that also continued. And I think on the more political level, I think you could have seen just sort of more emphasis on labor organizing and the importance of worker solidarity. You know, you might have had some campaigns, more vibrant campaigns around creating alternative ideas of what different forms of globalization could have taken. Seattle also sparked some really healthy conversations about racial justice in movements that I could have seen, you know, also expanding and having, you know, and I think this is honestly a fault in my book also, that you have had a more thoughtful understanding of white supremacy and its interlinkages with like neoliberal globalization exploitation. And I think many of these things would have still failed. Other things would have happened that would have drawn off energy in different directions. I think the street mobilizations would have eventually had to start petering out, especially because it would have been very hard to replicate a Seattle-level success because law enforcement was more ready for that. But the idea that the movement would have just disappeared to me is like, is as ahistorical as being like, it would have been a great success and like won all the things.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so I guess as a last question, and I should let you go here, but you know, in the time since now, 20 years really, the only time we've really seen any, at least in my understanding of it, a real sort of boomlet of this sort of organizing again was against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, in the later Obama years. And you know, labor was on that, and environmental groups were in on that, but it really didn't have a larger popular, you know, on the ground appeal. It didn't really seem to me as much as one might like. And then, you know, I think about the Rana Plaza collapse and the ways in which, you know, very little has changed in the global, at least labor system, in the last couple of decades. And so I guess my last question to you is a big one, which is, what is the future? Like, is there a future of progressive global governance? How do we move in a direction again where we can engage people there are people's interest in this. And I see this as well in, you know, coming from the sense that, and you talked about the rise of technology and the ways this, you know, can help activists intersect around the globe, is that we do have this like incredibly global world now. And if you do pay attention, like you can find out about all kinds of protests that are going on anywhere around the world almost immediately. And yet it hasn't been possible, or it hasn't happened where any real political organizing energy has sort of rejuvenated this movement.
Right.
Is that a take that you agree with or disagree with? And either way, how do we do better?
Yeah, it's what I think about all the time. So let me kind of go a bit chronologically. I think with TPP, there, in a weird way, was more of a mass popular awareness of that. It's just that it got channeled through the Sanders 2015-2016 campaign, right? Sanders helped make, like, TPP became one of his main kind of talking points, distinguishing himself hard from Hillary. I remember during that Democrat convention that some of the most frequent interruptions would be groups of people with anti-TPP signs. So there was an element of that. And I think the Sanders thing connects to where I do see elements of internationalism kind of popping up in some of the newer left social movements, right? That there's like certain internationalism in parts of Black Lives Matter. There's certainly attempts to bring more internationalism to Democratic Socialists of America, who seem like a healthy home for that, but also like if the your democratic socialists can't be internationalists, like we're shit out of luck. I think that the main way that this may happen is the two C's that are destroying our world right now, COVID and climate change, right? These are both things that just like, we either have sort of eco-apartheid fascism in the US, which is going to be terrible for most everyone, or we're going to have an internationalist solution, right? There's not really a like domestic social democratic way out of especially climate change, right? Like we could completely stop all emissions from the United States and still be pretty fucked as a world. So there's just like, I think that will have to lead to some internationalism. I think that sort of the rapid evolution of just sort of left-wing consciousnesses around different histories and issues in some ways is touching internationalism. And I really hope, and, you know, hope to be involved in these kind of projects of just like bringing that more to the forefront of, you know, making that awareness of like, yes, like it's great. We're learning the history of redlining and white supremacy and the all kinds of injustices in the US, guess what? Also overseas, but also like in different ways. I mean, one of my side hope dreams is that I think more internationalism would actually produce healthier conversations at home about some of our domestic challenges, right? When people are like, oh, like racialized categories that we understand in the US don't function the same everywhere in the world, helps people understand like how white supremacy functions in a more nuanced and sophisticated way. So that's me and my like,
that was like some of that critical race theory to me.
Yeah. it's worse. It's internationalist critical race theory. So I mean, not that I'm especially hopeful about this, but as far as like the concrete projects people could be working on, those are some of the places you know, working within these emergent left social movements combined with these issues that are just inherently global and especially climate change seems to me that those are the conditions that aren't like organically going to give rise to an internationalist left in the US, but are conditions that seem necessary and favorable to the attempt to build it. And, you know, part of the mission of recovering this history, especially from the late 90s, is like it did happen, like imperfectly, incomplete, but like, you know, I was talking to someone before, it's like in 2002 a bunch of like my friends and I had a party for when Lula won the presidency in Brazil, And it's like, what the hell are we, like a bunch of like mainly white college kids, like even think about this? But like the movement, right, created this atmosphere where we're like, yeah, like we're going to follow like elections in Bolivia. We're going to follow like the politics happening in Brazil. We're going to learn about this and that and, you know, have, you know, try to build these connections and get involved. So there's not something like organic to the DNA of the US left that makes it like totally parochial. You know, as with anything, it's a matter of what structures and contexts are being operated in and where people are putting their energies.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, to remind everybody in a cynical age that this stuff is not only possible, that it actually happened in a very significant way, seems like a great place to end the conversation. So, Paul, thank you so much.
Fun.
So that we've been talking again today with Paul Adler, an assistant professor at Colorado College, about his brand new book, No Globalization Without Representation, U.S. Activists and World Inequality, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. And again, this has been Eric Loomis, and we will be with you next time. Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.